Report on the Barnhouse Effect by Kurt Vonnegut. Let me begin by saying that I don't know any more about where Professor Arthur Barnhouse is hiding than anyone else does, save for one short, enigmatic message left in my mailbox on Christmas Eve. I have not heard from him since his disappearance a year and a half ago. What's more, readers of this article will be disappointed if they expect to learn how they can bring about the so-called Barnhouse effect. If I were able and willing to give away that secret, I would certainly be something more important than a psychology instructor. I've been urged to write this report because I did research under the professor's direction. But while I was his student, I was never entrusted with knowledge of how the mental forces could be released and directed. I would like to point out that the term Barnhouse effect is a creation of the press. It was never used by Professor Barnhouse. The name he chose for the phenomenon was dynamo psychism, or force of the mind. I cannot believe that there is a civilized person yet to be convinced that such a force exists, what with its destructive effects on display in every national capital. It has been common knowledge that some people are luckier than others with inanimate objects like dice. What Professor Barnhouse did was to show that such luck was a measurable force, which in his case could be enormous. There is an understandable tendency to look upon him as a supernatural visitation. The First Church of Barnhouse in Los Angeles has a congregation numbering in the thousands. He is godlike in neither appearance nor intellect. The man who disarms the world is single, shorter than the average American male, stout and adverse to exercise. His IQ is 143, which is good, but certainly not sensational. Neither he nor his powers fall outside the sphere of nature. His dynamo psychic radiations are subject to many known physical laws that apply in the field of radio. Hardly a person has not now heard the snarl of Barnhouse static on his home receiver. However, they differ from ordinary broadcast waves in several important ways. Their total energy can be brought to bear on any single point the professor chooses, and that energy is undiminished by distance. As a weapon, then, dynamo psychism has an impressive advantage over bacteria and atomic bombs. It enables the professor to single out critical individuals and objects, instead of slaughtering whole populations in the process of maintaining international equilibrium. As General Onus Barker told the House Military Affairs Committee, "Until someone finds Barnhouse, there is no defense against the Barnhouse effect. All efforts to jam or block the radiations have failed." There is talk of screening the population for men potentially as powerful dynamo psychically as a professor. Senator Warren Faust demanded funds for this purpose last month with the passionate declaration, "He who rules the Barnhouse effect rules the world." Commissar Kropotkin said much the same thing. So another costly armaments race, with a new twist, has begun. This race, at least, has its comical aspects. The world's best gamblers are being coddled by governments like so many nuclear physicists. There may be several hundred persons with dynamo psychic talent on Earth, myself included. But without knowledge of the professor's technique, they can never be anything but dice table despots. With the secret, it would probably take them 10 years to become dangerous weapons. Popularly, the age of Barnhouse is said to have begun a year and a half ago, on the day of Operation Brainstorm. That was when dynamo psychism became significant politically. Actually, the phenomenon was discovered in May 1942, shortly after the professor enlisted as an artillery private. From time to time, Private Barnhouse was invited to take part in games of chance. He usually begged off. But one evening, out of social grace, he agreed to shoot craps. "Shoot sevens, Pop," someone said. So, Pop shot sevens. 10 in a row to bankrupt the barracks. He retired to his bunk and, as a mathematical exercise, calculated the odds against his feet on the back of a laundry slip. His chances of doing it, he found, were 1 in almost 10 million. He tried to roll sevens again, but only got the usual assortment of numbers. He lay back for a moment, then resumed his toying with the dice. He rolled 10 more sevens in a row. He might have dismissed the phenomenon with a low whistle, but the professor instead mulled over the circumstances surrounding his two lucky streaks. There was one factor in common. On both occasions, the same thought train had flashed through his mind just before he threw the dice. It was that thought train which aligned the professor's brain cells into what has since become the most powerful weapon on Earth. Professional caution kept him from revealing his discovery immediately. He wanted more facts and a body of theory to go with them. Later, when the atomic bomb was dropped in Hiroshima, it was fear that made him hold his peace. At no time were his experiments, as Premier Slezak called them, a bourgeois plot to shackle the true democracies of the world. The professor didn't know where they were leading. In time, he came to recognize another startling feature of dynamo psychism. Its strength increased with use. Within 6 months, he was able to govern dice thrown by men the length of a barracks distant. By the time of his discharge in 1945, he could knock bricks loose from chimneys 3 miles away. Charges that Professor Barnhouse could have won the last war in a minute, but did not care to do so, are perfectly senseless. When the war ended, he had the range and power of a 37-millimeter cannon. His dynamo psychic powers graduated from the small arms class only after his discharge and returned to Wyandotte College. I enrolled in the Wyandotte Graduate School 2 years after the professor had rejoined the faculty. By chance, he was assigned as my thesis advisor. I was unhappy about the assignment, for the professor was, in the eyes of both colleagues and students, a somewhat ridiculous figure. "We're assigning you to Barnhouse as a sort of temporary thing," the dean of social studies told me. He looked apologetic and perplexed. "Brilliant man, Barnhouse, I guess. Difficult to know since his return, but his work before the war brought a great deal of credit to our little school." When I reported to the professor's laboratory for the first time, what I saw was more distressing than the gossip. Every surface in the room was covered with dust. Books and apparatus had not been disturbed for months. The professor sat napping at his desk. The only signs of recent activity were 3 overflowing ashtrays, a pair of scissors, and a morning paper with several items clipped from its front page. As he raised his head to look at me, I saw that his eyes were clouded with fatigue. "Hi," he said. "Just can't seem to get my sleeping done at night. Are you the young man I'm supposed to help with a thesis?" "Yes, sir," I said. In minutes, he converted my misgivings to alarm. "You an overseas veteran?" he asked. "Yes, sir." "Not much left over there, is there?" he frowned. "Enjoy the last war?" "No, sir." "Look like another war to you?" "Kind of, sir." "What can be done about it?" I shrugged. "Looks pretty hopeless." He peered at me intently. "Know anything about international law, the UN? "Only what I pick up from the papers." "Same here," he sighed. "Never used to pay any attention to international politics. Now I study them the way I used to study rats. Everybody tells me the same thing. Looks hopeless." "Nothing short of a miracle," I began. "Believe in magic?" he asked sharply. The professor fished 2 dice from his vest pocket. "I will try to roll 2s," he said. He rolled 2s, 3 times in a row. One chance in about 47,000 of that happening. There's a miracle for you. He beamed for an instant, then brought the interview to an end. He was not quick to take me into his confidence, and said no more about his trick with the dice. He set me the task of watching male rats cross electrified strips to get to food or female rats, an experiment that had been done to everyone's satisfaction in the 1930s. As though the pointlessness of my work were not bad enough, the professor annoyed me further with irrelevant questions. Think we should have dropped the atomic bomb on Hiroshima? And think every new piece of scientific information is a good thing for humanity? However, I did not feel put upon for long. Give those poor animals a holiday, he said one morning. I wish you'd help me look into a more interesting problem. Namely, my sanity. I returned the rats to their cages. What you must do is simple, he said. Watch the inkwell on my desk. If you see nothing happen to it, say so. I'll go quietly to the nearest sanatorium. I nodded uncertainly. He locked the laboratory door. If nothing happens to that inkwell, crazy as a bedbug is the only description of me that will do, he said. His eyes narrowed. To give you an idea of how crazy, I'll tell you what's been running through my mind when I should have been sleeping. I think maybe I can save the world. I think maybe I can make every nation be a have-nation and do away with war for good. I think maybe I can clear roads through jungles, irrigate deserts, build dams overnight. Yes, sir? Watch the inkwell. Dutifully and fearfully I watched. A high-pitched humming seemed to come from the inkwell. Then it began to vibrate alarmingly, and finally, to bound about the top of the desk. It stopped, glowed red, then popped in splinters with a blue-green flash. Perhaps my hair stood on end. The professor laughed gently. Magnets? I managed to say at last. Wish to heaven it were magnets, he murmured. It was then that he told me of dynamo psychism. It's me. And me alone. And it's awful. I'd say it was amazing and wonderful, I cried. If all I could do was make inkwells dance, I'd be tickled silly. But I'm no toy, my boy. If you like, we can drive around the neighborhood and I'll show you what I mean. He told me about pulverized boulders, shattered oaks, and abandoned farm buildings demolished within a 50-mile radius of the campus. Did every bit of it sitting right here, just thinking, not even thinking hard. There was a depressing pause. Up until a few days ago, I thought it best to keep my secret, for fear of what use it might be put to. Now I realize that I haven't any more right to it than a man has a right to own an atomic bomb. He fumbled through a heap of papers. This says about all that needs to be said, I think. He handed me a draft of a letter to the Secretary of State. Dear Sir, I have discovered a new force which costs nothing to use, and which is probably more important than atomic energy. I should like to see it used most effectively in the cause of peace, and am, therefore, requesting your advice as to how this might best be done. Yours truly, A. Barnhouse. I have no idea what will happen next, said the professor. There followed 3 months of perpetual nightmare wherein the nation's political and military great came at all hours to watch the professor's tricks. We were quartered in an old mansion near Charlottesville, Virginia, to which we had been whisked 5 days after the letter was mailed. We were labeled Project Wishing Well. And were classified as top secret. For companionship, we had General Onis Barker and the State Department's William K. Cuthrell. For the professor's talk of peace through plenty, they had indulgent smiles and much discourse on practical measures and realistic thinking. So treated, the professor, who had at first been almost meek, progressed in a matter of weeks towards stubbornness. He had agreed to reveal the thought train by means of which he aligned his mind into a dynamo psychic transmitter. But under Cuthrell's and Barker's nagging to do so, he began to hedge. Finally, at dinner one night, just after General Barker had read the secret orders for Operation Brainstorm, the professor announced, "The report may take as long as 5 years to write, maybe 20. The dismay occasioned by this flat announcement was offset somewhat by the exciting anticipation of Operation Brainstorm. "The target ships are on their way to the Caroline Islands at this very moment," the general declared ecstatically. "At the same time, 10 V-2s are being readied for firing in New Mexico, and 50 radio-controlled jet bombers are being equipped for a mock attack on the Aleutians. Just think of it!" Happily, he reviewed his orders. "At exactly 1100 hours next Wednesday, I will give you the order to concentrate, and you, Professor, will think as hard as you can about sinking the target ships, destroying the V-2s, and knocking down the bombers before they reach the Aleutians. Think you can handle it?" The professor turned gray. "As I told you before, I don't know what I can do," he added bitterly. "As for this Operation Brainstorm, I was never consulted about it, and it strikes me as childish and insanely expensive." General Barker bridled. "Sir," he said, "your field is psychology, and I wouldn't presume to give you advice in that field. Mine is national defense, and I'll ask you not to criticize my judgment." The professor appealed to Mr. Cuthrell. "Look, isn't it war and military matters that we're all trying to get rid of? Would it be a whole lot more significant for me to try moving cloud masses into drought areas and things like that? I admit, I know next to nothing about international politics, but it seems reasonable to suppose that nobody would want to fight wars if there were enough of everything to go around. Why, you could figure out what each country needs to make the most of its resources, and I could give it to them without costing American taxpayers a penny." "Eternal vigilance is the price of freedom," said the general heavily. Mr. Cuthrell threw the general a look of mild distaste. "Unfortunately, the general is right in his own way," he said. "I wish to heaven the world were ready for ideals like yours, but it simply isn't. We aren't surrounded by brothers, but by enemies. It isn't a lack of food or resources that has us on the brink of war. It's a struggle for power. Who's going to be in charge of the world? Our kind of people or theirs?" The professor nodded in reluctant agreement and arose from the table. "I beg your pardon, gentlemen. You are, after all, better qualified to judge what is best for the country. I'll do whatever you say." He turned to me. "Don't forget to wind the restricted clock and put the confidential cat out," he said gloomily, and ascended the stairs to his bedroom. In Virginia, the day for Operation Brainstorm was unseasonably cool. Inside, a log fire crackled in the fireplace, and the flames were reflected in the polished metal cabinets that lined the living room. All that remained of the room's lovely old furniture was a Victorian love seat, set squarely in the center of the floor, facing three television receivers. One long bench had been brought in for the 10 of us privileged to watch. The television screen showed, from left to right, the stretch of desert, which was the rocket target, the guinea pig fleet, and a section of the Aleutian sky through which the radio-controlled bomber formation would roar. At 10 minutes before H hour, General Barker came in, shepherding the professor before him. The professor was comfortably attired in sneakers, gray flannels, a blue sweater, and a white shirt open at the neck. The two of them sat side by side on the love seat. The general was rigid and perspiring. The professor was cheerful. "Bomber sighted," cried the Aleutian observers. "Rockets away," barked the New Mexico radio operator. All of us looked quickly at the big electric clock over the mantel, while the professor, a half smile on his face, watched the television sets. In hollow tones, the general counted away the seconds remaining. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, concentrate. Professor Barnhouse closed his eyes and stroked his temples. He held the position for a minute. The television images were scrambled, and the radio signals were drowned in the din of Barnhouse static. The professor sighed, opened his eyes, and smiled confidently. "Did you give it everything you had?" asked the general dubiously. "I was wide open," the professor replied. The television images pulled themselves together, and mingled cries of amazement came over the radios. The Aleutian sky was streaked with the smoke trails of bombers screaming down in flames. Simultaneously, there appeared high over the rocket target a cluster of white puffs, followed by faint thunder. General Barker shook his head happily. "By George," he crowed. "Well, sir, by George!" "Look," shouted the admiral seated next to me. "The fleet, it wasn't touched." "The guns seem to be drooping," said Mr. Cuthrell. We clustered about the television sets to examine the damage more closely. What Mr. Cuthrell had said was true. The ship's guns curved downward, their muzzles resting on the steel decks. We were so engrossed, in fact, that we didn't miss the professor until two short snarls of Barnhouse static shocked us into sudden silence. We looked around apprehensively. The professor was gone. A guard threw open the door to yell that the professor had escaped. He brandished his pistol in the direction of the gates, which hung open, limp, and twisted. In the distance, a speeding government station wagon topped a ridge and dropped from sight. The air was filled with smoke, for every vehicle on the grounds was ablaze. Pursuit was impossible. Mr. Cuthrell, who had rushed out onto the front porch, now slouched back into the room, reading a penciled note as he came. He thrust the note into my hands. "The good man left this under the door knocker. Perhaps our young friend here will be kind enough to read it to you gentlemen, while I take a restful walk through the woods." "Gentlemen," I read aloud, "as the first superweapon with a conscience, I am removing myself from your national defense stockpile. A. Barnhouse." Since that day, the professor has been systematically destroying the world's armaments. His activities haven't exactly resulted in peace, but have rather precipitated a bloodless and entertaining sort of war that might be called the War of the Tattletales. Every nation is flooded with enemy agents whose sole mission is to locate military equipment, which is promptly wrecked when it is brought to the professor's attention in the press. Just as every day brings news of more armaments pulverized by dynamo psychism, so has it brought rumors of the professor's whereabouts. During last week alone, 3 publications carried articles proving variously that he was hiding in an Inca ruin, in the sewers of Paris, and in the unexplored lower chambers of Carlsbad Caverns. Knowing the man, I am inclined to regard such hiding places as unnecessarily romantic. While there are numerous persons eager to kill him, there must be millions who would care for him and hide him. I like to think that he is in the home of such a person. One thing is certain. At this writing, Professor Barnhouse is not dead. Barnhouse static jammed broadcast not 10 minutes ago. In the 18 months since his disappearance, he has been reported dead some half dozen times. Each report has stemmed from the death of an unidentified man resembling the professor during a period free of the static. The first 3 reports were followed at once by renewed talk of rearmament. The saber-rattlers have learned how imprudent premature celebrations of the professor's demise can be. Those who would make war if they could, in every country in the world, wait in sullen silence for what must come, the passing of Professor Barnhouse. To ask how much longer the professor will live is to ask how much longer we must wait for the blessings of another world war. He is of short-lived stock. He might be expected to live then for perhaps 15 years more, if he can remain hidden from his enemies. When one considers the number and vigor of these enemies, however, 15 years seems an extraordinary length of time, which might be better revised to 15 days, hours, or minutes. The professor knows that he cannot live much longer. I say this because of the message left in my mailbox on Christmas Eve. Unsigned, typewritten on a soiled scrap of paper, the note consisted of 10 sentences. The first 9 of these, each a bewildering tangle of psychological jargon and references to obscure texts, made no sense to me at first reading. The 10th, unlike the rest, was simply constructed and contained no large words, but its irrational content made it the most puzzling sentence of all. I nearly threw the note away, thinking it a practical joke. For some reason, though, I added it to the clutter on top of my desk, which included, among other mementos, the professor's dice. It took me several weeks to realize that the message really meant something, that the first 9 sentences, when unsnarled, could be taken as instructions. The 10th still told me nothing. It was only last night that I discovered how it fitted in with the rest. I promised to have this report on its way to the publishers today. In view of what has happened, I am obliged to break that promise. The delay will not be a long one, for one of the few blessings accorded a bachelor like myself is the ability to move quickly from one abode to another. What property I want to take with me can be packed in a few hours. Fortunately, I am not without substantial private means, which may take as long as a week to realize in liquid and anonymous form. When this is done, I shall mail the report. I have just returned from a visit to my doctor, who tells me my health is excellent. With any luck, I shall live to a ripe old age, for my family on both sides is noted for longevity. Briefly, I propose to vanish. Sooner or later, Professor Barnhouse must die. But long before then, I shall be ready. So, to the saber-rattlers of today, and even, I hope, of tomorrow, I say be advised. Barnhouse will die, but not the Barnhouse effect. Last night, I tried once more to follow the oblique instructions on the scrap of paper. I took the professor's dice and then, with the last nightmarish sentence flitting through my mind, I rolled 50 consecutive 7s. Goodbye.